Hi, I'm Sima Shapiro, the host of the new Contemporary Lifestyle Radio Show for Women Over 40, featuring everything about your health, wealth, children, happiness, and anything else of interest to you, the listener. Please stay tuned. Hi and welcome. I'm Sima Shapiro, your host of For Women Over 40. Today we'll be talking with two people about the business of going to college, who tries it, what does it take to get there, and exactly how do you do it. Beth Gellis is a partner and co-founder of Acceptance Ahead, Inc., an educational consulting firm that specializes in college consulting located in Scarsdale, New York. Together with co-founder Nancy Stusen, they cater to high school students in both the U.S. and abroad. Beth has worked extensively with underserved students in need of college guidance through a Westchester County nonprofit organization that provides college counseling services to Yonkers High School students. They also run pro bono workshops for students and teachers on the various aspects of the college process. Sean Quinn is the New York City-based Director of Programs for Arbor Bridge, a tutoring company that offers one-on-one SAT and ACT instruction to students around the U.S. and in over 40 countries. A graduate of Columbia University and the University of Southern California, Sean tutored for several years before stepping into his present role. Now he helps families and counselors figure out the best plan for testing. This year, Sean and the Arbor Bridge team partnered with Beth to offer pro bono tutoring to her seniors in Yonkers. So welcome, Sean and Beth.
Thank you.
Hi, Sima. Thanks so much for having us.
So you know each other, is that correct?
That's right.
We do know
yeah.
each other.
Okay, so this will make it even better. So let's just start with your interest in this topic. Beth, just tell me a real small snippet as to how you got to this place.
Well, I've always been involved in the world of college admissions since college. I was a student at Harvard University, and I worked extensively in the admissions office there as a tour guide. After I graduated, I spent over 20 years conducting admissions interviews with Harvard undergrad applicants on both the East and West Coast. 5 years ago, I moved back with my family to the East Coast, and it was serendipitous because I met my business partner, Nancy Stusen. It was only natural that Nancy and I together launched Acceptance Ahead.
So who would give themselves the punishment of working with college students?
You mean the punishment of working with college students or high school students?
Well, with either, because I'm sure there's some college students who need help in changing schools, correct?
Yeah, there are students, usually this time of year, that need help transferring colleges because they might not have been happy in the fall of their freshman year. But many people look to a private college counselor because they're not getting enough individualized attention from their high school counselor.
So check in with Sean and tell me a little bit about your interest in this topic and your journey to where you are.
Sure. So I came into the college admissions world as an SAT tutor. First, when I lived in Buenos Aires, and then here in New York for Arbor Bridge. I love teaching the SAT and ACT because there are very specific ways to teach the test, and there are concrete, visible results. You can really help a student check off one important box in their effort to get into their dream school. So I still tutor now, but I also work with parents and consultants like that to help students figure out which test and testing timeline make the most sense for them.
As an overview, Beth, do you have any idea how many independent college advisors exist in the country?
Yes, I do. According to the Independent Educational Consulting Association, it listed between 7,000 and 8,000 independent consultants just in the United States. And that number does not include another 10,000 to 15,000 people that dabble on a part-time basis in some kind of college counseling. It's grown over 300% in the last 5 years.
And what kind of fees are associated with this type of work?
The fees vary widely. It really depends on the geographic region of the country, but it can range from several thousand dollars all the way up to tens of thousands of dollars. And consultants can charge a variety of fees for their services. Some charge hourly. Some offer what they call a comprehensive fee, which is everything, soup to nuts. And some people do it a la carte, so they offer different pieces like just editing, or if someone needs an art portfolio, or if somebody needs just interview preparation, they would charge a specific fee for that service. But what's really important is that families that get involved with a private counselor should have a genuine understanding of how they're going to be charged. They need to feel comfortable with what they're getting because sometimes they need to dictate the exact services that their son or daughter wants to receive.
I wanted to address the issue of economics a little later in our program, but Sean, I feel really compelled to just state that I am definitely of a different generation, and we absolutely did not have these types of ancillary support teams helping us do our college apps, our admissions essays. So I'm wondering, where do economics factor in all this? This money is pricey probably for most people, and yet most high schoolers can use this. Can you address this issue?
Yeah, you know, I agree with you. It's changed drastically since, you know, I was in high school too, in terms of I didn't know about independent education consultants. I didn't know many of my classmates that were doing tutoring. But I think college has gotten so competitive over the years that it's become almost necessary to do some form of tutoring, some form of outside consulting. And those fees vary according to students' needs and a student's means. So there are more economic ways of tutoring, of enrolling in a group class or working with a private tutor online versus in person can be more affordable. So there are options for every price range for students that can aid them in this process.
I guess I do need to understand this. Where did this shift occur? How come it's become so competitive? Do you mean to say that it wasn't competitive during my era?
I think a few factors come into play. There are a lot more international students that are in the mix right now, and because of the internet, the accessibility of applying to colleges through the Common Application reaches every corner of the universe, and students have access to a lot more information than they did back 25 years ago when we were applying to schools. It's competitive because colleges do run a business. So it become competitive largely because of international students and also the accessibility of the Common Application. Kids can now apply anywhere between 8 and 15 schools. They answer one primary Common Application essay, and they don't have to keep redoing that essay for particular schools, so it makes it easier for them to just click and send. So that's why applications have soared, especially in the last 10 years.
At what point does a family decide they need a college advisor versus an educational consultant versus whatever it is that your guidance counselor can provide for you?
Guidance counselors have a very, very heavy caseload of students. I mean, the current counselor-to-student ratio right now is listed at a staggering. There are 476 students assigned to one guidance counselor. That's the national average. And when we talk about the state of California, the numbers become even bleaker because there the ratio is about 1,000 students to one counselor.
Wow.
But we can put all those ratios and numbers aside. The fact is that the school guidance counselor has a tremendous amount of work to do for every student that they work with. They have to write a letter of recommendation on behalf of the student. They have to put together an entire package to send to each school that the student is applying to, and that includes the high school transcript, the school report. They have to keep track of the teachers that are sending the letters of recommendation, and all of these tasks are very time-consuming. Private college counselors don't have any of these responsibilities except for paying attention to the student and their needs. Another interesting statistic is that on average, most students receive a mere 38 minutes of personalized counseling over all 4 years of high school. I think that now it's become kind of the norm in certain areas of the country, particularly in the wealthier and the higher educated affluent suburbs where people want a private counselor that's immediately accessible, someone to answer their questions and really understand a student's needs and goals so that they can help guide the student.
Sure. Beth, briefly take me through the process. You meet with a family, and then what?
Well, Nancy and I like to meet with families first. We have what we call a candidacy assessment, and we typically meet with the student and one parent or two parents so that we can discuss our services that we provide and we can all see if we're a good fit for each other. Lots of people hire us at different points in the process, but the majority of our clients begin working with us in the middle of sophomore year so we can really get to know them and we can start to recommend courses for them. We can help them develop their extracurricular activities. We help them recommend different summer programs to help them build upon their developing interests. When it comes time to start thinking about visiting schools, we help generate a list of colleges. Nancy and I visit many schools during the year, so we're able to determine which college programs match a student's interests and what college culture is appropriate for the student. Sometimes kids might have a particular need, like they want to meet with coaches if they're an athletic star or if they have some kind of musical or artistic prowess and they need to develop an art portfolio or they need to make some kind of video of dance for an audition. Those very specific pieces of expertise we defer to other outside service providers. providers because we are very general in what we do, and we frequently recommend outside service people that are specialists in those fields.
So
we also refer kids to people like Sean at Arbor Bridge and other tutoring professionals for ACT and SAT test prep. That's not something that we do.
Who else would be another type of service provider? Name some of the, not necessarily the names of the companies, but tell me the genres which are the spokes of your wheel.
There are some people that just concentrate on Ivy League admissions. There are some people that work only with kids that have learning differences. There's a whole area called therapeutic counseling, and those counselors work not just finding colleges, but maybe secondary schools or other boarding schools or summer programs for kids that might have emotional difficulties or are at risk.
And this is who you would refer out to? This is really interesting. And again, what would you term yourself? You call yourself a educational consultant?
We call ourselves college counselors. An educational consultant is a little bit more general than that, and they can handle anything from recommending graduate schools, preschools, secondary school programs, and helping find the proper environment for kids to thrive. And a college advisor really specializes in the college search and application process, and it's primarily for high school students.
Let's start with the basic process, Sean. When we think of college preparation, I think everyone knows all about SATs. I think a lot of people know less about the ACTs, but the truth is that this whole process demands more. Let's start with the basic questions about the testing. Why are they so important, and what weight do they carry in terms of the application?
So the SAT and ACT are important because they offer college admissions officers an objective standard they can use to separate applicants. How GPA is calculated and how difficult classes are, that really varies by high school. So it's important that admissions have an outside objective way of comparing students. SAT and ACT scores serve as that comparison point. So knowing about these tests and understanding which is best for your son or daughter is more important than ever now that the SAT is changing drastically in March.
And again, referencing this SAT, can you very briefly tell me how it's changing? And can you also add the difference between SAT and ACT?
The new SAT is actually getting closer to the ACT. The new SAT is changing its scoring system. It's going back to the 1600 scale. It now is going to test grammar in the context of whole passages, just like the ACT. The math is changing pretty dramatically. They're adding concepts, trigonometry and pre-calc, and they're also adding a no calculator section, so students will have to learn to part ways with their TI-84. On the other hand, the ACT and how that's different, the ACT is on a 36-point scale, and two of its main differences from the SAT are, one, the science section, which actually tests little outside science knowledge and focuses on students' ability to interpret data quickly, and two, the pacing. Students have less time per question on the ACT than on the SAT.
We're talking today with two people about the business of going to college, who tries to get into college, what does it take to get there, and exactly how do you go about doing it. How long would it take a student to study up before they take the SAT or the ACT, and how long do those actual tests take?
So how long the process takes depends on a student's target schools and the student's starting score. So we always advise students to take a full-length diagnostic SAT or ACT before starting prep. We want them to take a full-length practice test and then see what their starting score is, and then they're working with an independent consultant, speak with them about the target schools, and then come up with a full plan. That first practice test serves as a baseline, and then after that test, students should plan on at least 3 months of preparation. Most students begin prep in the fall or winter of their junior year and then take the real test in the spring. But this time frame varies tremendously based on students' course load and extracurriculars, and that's something we talk about with the family and before making a recommendation. The tests themselves take 4 hours each, and that varies if the student has extra time due to a diagnosed learning difference or testing accommodation.
And how much does it cost to take the tests?
The cost to take the test is inexpensive. It's less than $100. And in some states, it's actually free because they take it through the school system. A lot of states are adding the new SAT as a mandatory test because of its connection to the Common Core. They're replacing the standardized test in schools with the SAT. For a lot of students, this will be free. In many states, the ACT is already free and given each April of the junior year.
And can they take the test more than once?
Absolutely. Students usually take the test 2 to 3 times to try to maximize their score and do the best they can.
And can colleges see that they've taken it more than once?
That depends on the college. I mean, some colleges ask that students report their scores from all of the tests taken. Other colleges allow students to send only their best scores. This information varies depending on the college and is available on each college's admissions page.
And again, to the previous question I had asked, how are they evaluated in the admissions process? What percentage do you think they make up of the value for the school?
My business partner, Nancy, and I have visited a wide range of colleges throughout the country, and we've spent considerable time speaking with admissions officers. What we've learned is that the number one component of a student's application is always the high school transcript, because it's something that showcases a student's academic behavior day in and day out of the classroom. The next factor that is scrutinized heavily is usually the SAT or the ACT score. And as Sean was saying previously, the score really does serve as an equalizer. There are some schools, and the list is expanding today, that have gone what we call test optional or test flexible, and they don't require any longer for students to submit every single standardized test score. Applying to those kinds of schools is really ideal for a high school student who might be stellar in the classroom, but for some particular reason, maybe test anxiety, they've not done really well on particular standardized tests. So if the student doesn't want his or her scores to indicate a lack of aptitude or effort, the high school transcript and the teacher letters of recommendation are really what become paramount when admissions folks evaluate those types of applicants.
And do those colleges include Ivy League schools, or do you traditionally find that kind of flexibility in other types of colleges?
The Ivy League schools generally require more tests than other schools do, but there are a handful of very highly selective schools that have gone test optional or test flexible.
And how long has that trend been going on?
It's hard to say how long the trend has been going on because it changes from year to year, but I think it's been in existence for at least 5 years.
I find it fascinating that you're making mention of those people who may have learning disabilities, who approach learning with differing ways, and you're telling me that some of these tests adjust themselves for this. Is that correct?
I mean, I think the current buzzword is that they get testing accommodations, and we've worked with students that have been awarded various different types of accommodations. Those kinds of things include anything from extended time for the test, maybe a use of a computer when they write their essays. They might need extra or extended breaks during the actual exam, and reading and seeing accommodations. The most common accommodation that we've seen is when kids receive what they call extra time on the ACT or the SAT. Typically, those students go into a separate room during the exam, and they receive something like time and a half or even twice the time normally allocated for the test. It really depends on what the student's disability is, but what we see really is if students receive some kind of testing accommodation in high school, then what they get on the SAT or ACT mirrors the type of accommodations their school gives them.
I think this is fascinating. I need to address this one more time. Would a college be less inclined to take a student if they're given the knowledge that they are given these accommodations?
The college has no indication anywhere on the exam scores that a student has received any kind of extra time.
And who makes the determination that they are to be given more time, a different room? Who makes that determination?
Students have to actually apply to the college board to get extra time. It usually requires some kind of an evaluation, a psychological exam or a medical exam.
And how long has this been in existence?
More than 5.
More than 5. And again, Sean, if test scores do not reflect the student's aptitude, and Beth was very explicit in her explanation of this. Again, I think that aptitude isn't necessarily measured through testing. So, Sean, talking about students' aptitude versus the SAT tests that they may take, sometimes aptitude is absolutely present, but again, for a variety of reasons, the SAT scores don't monitor them. Beth is talking about teacher recommendations, but I'm wondering what other external things could be included in a package to the college to prove that while this student may not test well, they are highly capable of being productive and in fact may thrive at this college.
As Beth mentioned, I think the most important thing overall is always going to be the high school transcript and what courses the student has gone out of their way to take and how they performed on them. But I also think that a lot of times that's a little too easy to say that a student just doesn't test well. There's a lot of factors, and I think taking a diagnostic or a practice test and looking at that, we can see if a student really doesn't know the content, which is aptitude, or if the student doesn't know the strategy. In both cases, students can take the test better. If test anxiety is preventing them from doing well in the test, that's also something that we can work with them on, or they can practice and follow concrete strategies to do better on the test. So there are always ways to increase the score, and even the new SAT is actually more in line with the Common Core, and we'll actually be testing a lot more of what the students are covering in their high school curriculum. So it is becoming closer to a measure of aptitude and high school achievement.
And Beth, if you really have a student who clearly has demonstrated ability, but for whatever reason can't convey this admirably on an SAT or an ACT, do you recommend that they also try to fill up their coffer with volunteer work, other ways in which they might intern and get other referrals? Do all of those other possibilities ever come into play?
Absolutely, Sima. We never, ever want to package students so that they look good for a college application. It has to be genuine. It has to be something that the student is interested in. But I think what you're talking about are hooks. And a hook means something that really offers strong positioning for an applicant and dramatically improves their odds of admissions. It could be anything from an artistic or a musical talent. Maybe there is some absolutely wonderful piece of volunteering where they've raised hundreds of thousands of dollars for an organization or a charity. Sometimes recruited athletes, it depends on what sport it is or where they're applying, but other hooks are obvious, like underrepresented students, geographical places in the country. It always helps if you're from places like Wyoming or Montana. But we really recommend that students pursue one or two of their passions and they go deep in it. Colleges are no longer looking for well-rounded students. They want well-rounded classes. And the word that we've heard a lot is angular. They want kids to become experts in one area. It doesn't mean they have to find a cure for cancer, but maybe they have demonstrated particular aptitude with science research and they've volunteered extensively at a local museum conducting that kind of research, things like that.
And Sean, what are the colleges actually looking for in an applicant?
Well, I agree with Beth that they're looking for a unique identity for that student, someone that is passionate about what they're pursuing, someone who has identified a niche or something that they're genuinely interested in. And I think it's not about the packaging or about selecting something to be attractive to the school, but communicating honestly what a student is engaged in and interested in. I think that's the biggest thing. And then there's gatekeepers like the SAT or ACT that are boxes that we have to check off. But that's just one part of the application process.
So what do most colleges really want from their students? Or does the question vary by ranking of colleges, amount of money that colleges cost? How do they make these decisions?
I think that colleges across the board, they want students who have challenged themselves and have displayed strong academic performance. They want kids who have pursued their passions and maybe have gone deep in one or two particular areas. But they really want kids to be able to articulate on their application what they are able to bring to that specific college community. Just because a student has perfect grades and perfect test scores, who are they as people? What are they going to be able to contribute to the campus? Will they be a good roommate? Will they be a good community member inside the classroom as well as outside of the classroom? They're looking to build a community, and they want to ensure that they have a wide range of students to do that.
Mm-hmm. I think I would be remiss if I didn't ask either or both of you, what are your feelings about college these days? It used to be that for everyone who got into an Ivy League school, they were fairly well certain that they would get out and find a job. I think that those statistics have shifted dramatically in the last 5 years, especially with the recession. And I'm wondering if your perception of what college offers students has changed. Sean?
Yeah, I think there's partly some truth to that, the fact that maybe the name branding of a school doesn't mean as much as it used to even 10 years ago. But I think nowadays it's more important for a student to find the right fit rather than going to an Ivy League college. So it's more about finding a college that will enable them to pursue the professional passion that they want. And I think that is a big shift from, you know, even when I was applying to colleges where the pressure was to get into the top name schools. I think now that pressure still exists. But in order to get a job and get in this competitive job market, I think it's more important for students to find a great fit that's going to allow them to find and pursue their professional passion.
And Beth?
And I agree with Sean about finding the right fit, because I think students thrive in an environment where they can go in thinking one thing, but once they're exposed to a wide variety of classes and different disciplines, maybe something else sparks their interest. There's a whole stream of research that shows that liberal arts educations are still incredibly important, even when applying to places like medical school or the business field. There's all sorts of research that documents how students that learn how to think and analyze different passages in literature or dissecting a piece of history, if they can apply those skills to a business situation or to a medical situation, that's what really comes in handy. So it's okay for students to apply to schools undecided. They might not know what they want going in, but if they get a broad exposure across many different subjects, it's really about skill development and less about one particular vocation that they're aiming to achieve afterwards. And I think that having that broad range really will help them in whatever fields they're pursuing.
And I'm asking you a question as a real layman. When colleges are looking at the next crop of students coming in, do they internally decide how many students will be able to get in given a base criteria where their parents are alumni? They have a base criteria, and then the students will need to be over a certain level on their SATs and ACTs. Do they have a base criteria, and then they're going to want the civic-minded or the volunteering or the students who've gone out for social causes? Do they have their internal gatekeeper mechanisms for allowing certain percentages of each group to come in, or do they actually evaluate every application on its own merit?
I can comment on the inner workings. I think, Sima, it's a combination of both. They definitely have certain benchmarks that they want their students to be able to achieve, but they do give every applicant a fair read, and schools vary. Some schools have different committees. They vary by geographic region of the country, or they have different clusters of students that they evaluate. I'm not sure what the measure would be at all of them. But we hear lots of different stories, like each year a college has to evaluate its needs. Maybe they need a new trombonist for the marching band. Maybe they need a new right fielder for the baseball team. They have specific needs that they do need to fill, but they certainly look at all of those other criteria, like if a student is ninth generation, so they have that legacy status, or if they've done something incredibly meaningful in their community, they certainly take that into account, so they give each student a fair read.
Mm-hmm. We're out of time right now, and I'm wondering what brief thoughts would you like to leave for the listener? Beth?
I would say that it's important for kids to really find the right school where they can thrive and develop a range of interests and dabble into many different subject areas. I think that we put a lot of pressure on kids in today's generation to find the best school, but it's really about finding the best school for each student.
Mm-hmm.
And it should be a fun and enlightening process when students begin to think about the next 4 years of their lives.
And Sean?
I agree with Beth that I think this process is all about finding the best fit for the student, and test prep is just one part of that. So after a student finds a great group of colleges he wants to apply to, then looking at the score ranges to determine what score they need to shoot for is one of the next steps. These tests are high stakes and they have a terrible reputation, but they are manageable stakes. And I think it's really important to know that a student can always improve their practice score by taking concrete steps to do so and kind of check that box off.
We've been talking today with two people about their work in the field of college preparation, the taking of SATs, ACTs, and other pragmatics intended to provide an edge into getting into college. Sean Quinn can be found at arborbridge.com, Beth Gellis at acceptanceahead.com. I really want to thank you guys for unraveling this in a way that even I could understand. Thanks so much for being with me.
Thank you, Sima.
Thank you, Sima, so much.
Thank you to the listener for joining us today. I'm Sima Shapiro, your host of For Women Over 40. And until next time, I hope you take care.